Thank you. So many thanks to the organizers. It's always great to be back in Canada. I was going to do my whole talk in Canadian, but I've forgotten most of it. So I'm going to have to do it in American English. I hope you'll forgive me. I used to actually speak very good Canadian. I really did, but somehow it left me. I don't know what happened. So, right, so I want to talk about... So first of all, I have to say right off the bat that this is really a talk about classification of C-star algebras. However, the main examples that we still have left, I believe, come from dynamical systems. So in some sense, in some sense, this really isn't a talk about dynamics. This is really a talk about C-star classification. But as I say, the main examples come from classical dynamical systems. So that's what we will look at. So let me start off reviewing roughly what the Elliott classification program is all about. So let's suppose that this is the universe of simple separable nuclear C-star algebras. Simple, of course, means no non-trivial ideals, and nuclearity is an analog of amenability, if you haven't seen this before. It's a very natural class, and it certainly covers most of the first examples of C-star algebras that you will encounter. Not all, but a great many of them. So what is the question here? So if we look at this, this is supposed to be all of them, all of the C-star algebras with this property, and inside is a subset of the classifiable ones. Okay, and let me explain roughly what I mean here. So you can attach to a C-star algebra A an invariant, a triple, which is the K0 group, the K1 group, and the simplex of tracial states, okay, which of course may or may not be empty. But anyway, we can throw it in there, and this is called the Elliott invariant, and this invariant has some additional structure which isn't relevant to the talk, so I'll just say it very briefly. We regard this as an ordered group, and there's a natural action of the tracial space on K0, and all of this structure is somehow buried, but that's all I'm going to say about it. Anyway, we can just think of the Elliott invariant as this triple, and the conjecture, Elliott's conjecture for a long time, was that you should have something like A is isomorphic to B. So for two simple separable nuclear C-star algebras, if and only if these invariants are the same. So that was the conjecture. So in other words, the conjecture was that this picture is wrong, right? The conjecture was that this line and this line should be the same. Yeah, that was the conjecture. And there were just tons and tons of wonderful contributions here. Kirchberg Phillips showed that purely infinite C-star algebras live in here, and there were just many, many great results. Elliott, Gong, Lee, Dadalat, Mikhail Rordam, and Huaxin Lin, and many, many other people. And, you know, over the years, this boundary just kept getting pushed out and pushed out. We got more examples and more examples, and this seemed to perhaps be converging to the conjecture. But then Mikhail Rordam put a point in the middle. He showed that there are C-star algebras which cannot be classified via their K-theory, modeling a construction of Jesper Vilatzen. This is his famous paper where you have a simple C-star algebra with both an infinite and a finite projection. Okay? And then came... So at that point, the conjecture is dead. Okay? There's no hope of classifying via K-theory. However, there was an important development 2 years ago, I guess, by Andrew Toms. So Andrew Toms put another point in the intersection. But his example, so he again constructed examples of C-star algebras which cannot be classified by the Elliott invariant, but his example had a very, very important feature which doesn't appear in Mikhail's example. Namely, Andrew's examples were of a very special type. Okay, these were inductive limits of matrices over commutative C-star algebras. So they were very special C-star algebras. So the point of Andrew's examples is that not only does the conjecture fail, we already knew that from Mikhail, but not only does it fail, it even fails for very special C-star algebras, for inductive limits of sort of basic building blocks. Okay? So that was a problem. And then we're stuck and we think to ourselves, geez, what should we do? Right? Does this mean the end of the classification program or what's gonna go on? And I would argue, I don't think everyone would agree, but I would argue that if we didn't have any examples that needed classified, then the program would have been finished. But the fact is that we do have examples that we would like to classify, and therefore I think the classification problem really got harder, because now what we need to know is not whether or not this line and this line agree. Now what we need to know is what belongs here and what belongs here. And that seems to be a harder question. So the problem, the problem that I want to talk about today is to determine whether or not you can classify cross-product C-star algebras. This is an abelian C-star algebra, and here phi is supposed to be a minimal homeomorphism. Okay, and again, the point is that we don't know at present whether these examples, which are of great interest to us, we don't know if these examples fall here, or whether they fall here, or where. Okay, and so that's the problem that I want to talk about. Where do they belong? And I'm even going to make a little conjecture. I mean, I don't deserve any credit for this because I think many people will conjecture exactly the same thing. The conjecture is that, well, let me say it like this. We should have that in the case that X has finite dimension, topological covering dimension, when it has finite dimension, we should be able to classify these things. And otherwise, not. And David Kerr, so in Barcelona last month, David Kerr gave a very nice talk where he has found a way to take, so as I mentioned, Mikhail's examples and Andrew's examples as well, these are both based on some techniques that go back to Vilatzin. And Vilatzin gave examples of C-star algebras with some sort of unexpected or pathological properties using inductive limit techniques. Okay, so these algebras that they construct, as I say, are inductive limits. But what David outlined last month is a way to take inductive limit techniques, in particular Vilatzin's techniques, and transfer those to dynamical systems with the same bad properties. Okay, so what David has done is constructed a dynamical system where the cross product has perforation in the K0 group, which isn't important except to say that it's almost a proof that in the infinite dimensional case you're going to be here. Okay? And I strongly believe that if he was to take what he can do for Vilatzin's examples and try to redo it with Andrew's examples, because these are also based on Vilatzin's techniques, I strongly believe that David will be able to construct cross products of dynamical systems, which really absolutely are out here. Okay, and that should happen pretty soon. So this part of the conjecture, I would say, is very near to being done. And what I want to report on is some recent progress in this part of it. Okay, I want to report on what we can now say when the space has finite dimension. So let me review. Let me review some history. Very quickly, so what we do know is that if X is a Cantor set, so when X is a Cantor set, you take a minimal diffeomorphism. Ian Putnam showed that the cross product is an AT algebra, and then George classified the AT algebras. So we know that cross products by Cantor sets definitely belong to the classifiable subset. All right, and then of course Giordano Putnam Scow took that even further, but today I'm just going to focus on classification of the cross products. So that's one case that we know. We also know if this is a real rank zero C star algebra, if the cross product happens to have a ton of projections, which I won't give the technical definition, but it just means a lot of projections. If you know that the cross product has a ton of projections and you have finite dimension, then Huaxin Lin and Chris Phillips have shown that these things are tracially AF and hence belong to the classifiable subset. Okay, so we know the Cantor set. We know the real rank zero finite dimension case. Those are classifiable. And so now what we need to do is get rid of this. Right? As soon as we get rid of the real rank zero condition, then we will understand the classification of these things. There are also some one-dimensional cases that are known, not least of which, of course, is the irrational rotation algebras. Yes, when you have the circle and you take a cross product by a rotation, irrational rotation. But there are other examples. Huaxin Lin and Hiroki Matsui have studied these cases and got some nice results. So these are examples that are known. And of course, I think it's clear that this is quite strong evidence that we should be able to classify these cross products in the case that you have finite dimension. But what I want to talk about is a bit more evidence and some recent developments in this program. All right? So to discuss these recent developments, I have to take a quick diversion and define something called the Jiangsu algebra, and this is also a service to Elin, so that, I don't know, now you can skip it or whatever. But let me quickly talk about the Jiangsu algebra because it plays a very important role in this whole classification scheme. So let me say a few words about it. So let's consider a C-star algebra, which I can't remember. Can anybody remind me? Wilhelm, when he spoke in Barcelona, what did he call this generalized dimension drop interval where you use UHF algebras instead of matrices? Does anybody remember?
The notation?
The notation, yeah.
Maybe it was a D with a 2 subscript.
That is a D. All right. Let's go with D. That's good. So let's consider the following algebra. Let's consider the set of functions, continuous functions, that go from the unit interval into the UHF algebra of type 2 infinity, the infinite tensor product of 2 by 2 matrices. Tensor, the UHF algebra of type 3 infinity, and the conditions here are that F should be continuous. And at the left end point, it should take its values in the left algebra. And at the right end point, it should take its values, take its values in the right algebra, okay? So what are we looking at? We're simply looking at all the continuous paths that start here and end here. Okay? That's the algebra we're considering. Right. Well, here's a little exercise. Notice that this C star algebra, right? So this is a set of continuous functions. It embeds, it's a sub algebra of this thing. Right? And this C star algebra has a ton of traces, right? All the traces here, it's actually isomorphic to the traces on 0, 1. In particular, there's a lot of them. All right, so this algebra also has a lot of different tracial states on it, but the exercise is to show there exists an endomorphism from D to 3. There exists an endomorphism on this generalized dimension drop algebra such that when you look at the induced map on the tracial space, it's a single point. Okay? So what's this induced map? I mean, right, when you have an endomorphism from here to here, you get an affine map from the tracial space here back to the tracial space here, just by composition, okay? And the exercise is to show that there is an endomorphism which takes that huge tracial space and collapses it to a point, right? And this, I put exercise in quotes there because it actually would be nice to have a proof of this that was elementary. So if somebody could find an elementary proof of this fact, this is a fact, by the way, but if you could find an elementary proof of this fact, that would be a nice thing to know. But anyway, okay, so that's a fact. And how do we get the Jiangsu algebra? So Wilhelm Winter emailed me and told me he could prove this. I confess I haven't seen the proof, but he's a very, very trustworthy guy. So anyway, here's the fact. If you consider this stationary inductive limit, then the limit is the Jiangsu algebra. So I'm going to take this, for the purposes of this talk, we're just going to take this as the definition. All right, we'll take this as the definition of the Jiangsu algebra. And as far as I know, I mean, this is quite neat, actually, because it gives a dynamic construction of the Jiangsu algebra. But even if Wilhelm has made a mistake, which I highly, highly doubt, but even if he has, there is an algebra out there which satisfies the properties I'm about to write down, and I'm quite confident that this is actually true. So let me. Oh no, is that right? Sorry. My apologies. Okay. Right. So what do we know? What do we know about this algebra Z, this Jiangsu algebra? Well, we know quite a few interesting things. The first thing that we know is that its K-theory is the same as the complex numbers. Okay? So this is a unital C-star algebra. It's a simple C-star algebra, and it has a unique trace. Actually, that part at least is clear from this construction. But the surprising fact is that this C-star algebra has exactly the K-theory of the complex numbers, namely the K0 group is Z and the K1 group is 0. But we know more than that. We also know that the K groups of any C star algebra A are the same thing as the K groups of A tensor Z. However, there's an important caveat here. This is just as abstract abelian groups. So remember I said there's some other structure on the K0 group. There's an order structure. And it's possible that the order structure could get screwed up here, but just as abstract abelian groups, these things are always isomorphic. All right? And we even know more than that. We know that if the K0 group of A is unperforated, then, in fact, the Elliott invariant of A is isomorphic in the technical sense, all the other structure. Yes, the Elliott invariant of A is the same thing as the Elliott invariant of A tensor Z. So what you can think of, and I might even say what you should think of, is that this process of tensoring with Z, it doesn't really change anything. Okay? Certainly, if you have a very mild hypothesis on K0, it literally does not change the Elliott invariant. What it does is it somehow regularizes, smooths out any sort of pathologies you might have. All right? And in particular, let me also point out that, right, the original conjecture, if you'll believe this fact, what does the original conjecture then predict? The original conjecture then predicts that you should have an isomorphism. All right? Because the conjecture said if you have the same Elliott invariant, the algebra should be isomorphic. So if you know that A and A tensor Z have the same Elliott invariant, they should be isomorphic. All right? And this, for the von Neumann algebra crowd, let me point out that I think another nice way to think of Z here is it's in a very real sense an analog of the hyperfinite 2-1 factor, right? If you think of, there's problems with this analogy because there's only one hyperfinite 2-1 factor and there are lots and lots of simple nuclear C-star algebras, but if you'll forget that little fact for just a second, let me point out that this is sort of like tensoring R with R, tensoring the hyperfinite 2-1 with itself, and what do you get back? You get back R. Right, and so this is what we sort of would expect to happen in C-star algebras, and there's also a very nice result. So for the 2-1 factor folks, right? There's a nice result that characterizes C-star algebras that have this property in the same way that you have the characterization of Macduff factors. So remember, right? If you have a 2-1 factor and you look at its ultra product, there's an embedding of the 2-1 factor into that ultra product, and then you look at the relative commutant. And if there's a copy of the hyperfinite 2-1 in there, then it's Macduff. It satisfies this equation with the hyperfinite 2-1. And the same result is true for C-star algebras. Namely, you take the C-star algebra, you consider its ultra product, you look to the relative commutant of the natural embedding, and if there's a copy of Z in there, then it's Z-stable. It satisfies this isomorphism. Okay? So this is not... At first, it might bother you. It might seem like this is a strange thing to consider. But there's very good reason to get used to this, to not be bothered by this idea of tensoring with Z. And as I say, if the conjecture is going to be true, you should have that equation anyway in almost all cases. In particular, I should also mention that these cross products, at least in the case where you have a manifold, if you have a manifold, then these cross products do satisfy this unperforated condition. Okay, so this is satisfied by many of the examples that we're looking at. All right, so that's a little digression on the Jang-Su algebra. So now let me get back to the classification. So here's a two-step. Here's a two-step approach to classification. So this is quite general, and this is what I was saying at the beginning, right? That really my talk is about classification. And those are the main examples. So let me be a bit more general at this point. Let me make a standing assumption now that whenever you see A or B, that this is going to be a simple nuclear unital C-star algebra. I guess that's all I need. And also, let's assume that the tracial space is not empty. Okay? And again, let me remark that these examples have all those properties. The minimality ensures simplicity. Nuclearity is well known. And because Z is an amenable group, you always have a trace. Okay? So the examples that I'm talking about certainly have all of these properties. Right, so that's a standing assumption. And now I'm going to make one more. Namely, I'm going to assume that... Sorry. This will come later. That will be at the next step. So for now, those are the standing assumptions. Fine. So what's the two-step program? The two-step program is to first classify up to the Z stability. In other words, restrict to not algebras with this, but A tensor Z. So that's the first step. Okay. In other words, try to classify not A, but try to classify A tensor Z. See if you can get those things into the classifiable case. Then the second step to the program, is to understand when A is Z stable. And so what I mean by that is, a nice thing to prove, and indeed this is a very worthwhile problem, is to show that our examples are Z stable. We don't know that. We don't know if these cross products are Z stable, but we have some very encouraging evidence. Andrew Thompson and Marius Dadelot have shown that these cross products, they have embeddings not quite of Z into the algebra A, but of the building blocks of Z into A. And as I say, via this ultra product characterization, this is quite encouraging. I mean, this somehow gives you hope that you can really show that these cross products always are Z stable. We don't know that, as I say, but it's there is very good evidence to believe that that's true. And so anyway, this would be the two-step approach to classification. First, classify these guys, then show that the examples you're interested in actually satisfy this, and if you do that, then you're done, right? Because then you would have shown that A itself belongs to the classifiable case, to the classifiable subset. All right. I actually wanted to say a little bit more here. So I said we have good evidence that this may always be true for cross products, but we actually know that this is true in the real rank zero case. So if your cross product, if C of X cross Z has real rank zero, then we know it's Z stable. We know that it satisfies this tensor product equation. And we also know, and this is what David Kerr has definitely done, we also know that this little isomorphism is not satisfied in the infinite dimensional case. Okay, we know that there are cross products in the infinite dimensional case that do not satisfy this isomorphism. But in any case, the finite dimensional case, we can hope for this, and there's good reason. All right, so I'm going to focus on step one here, and hope that someone will eventually handle step two. All right. So we've reduced the problem in some sense. Not reduce the problem, but we're going to focus on the first problem and see what we can say about classifying these cross products up to Z stability. All right. Well, so now there's an approach to this approach, right? There's an approach to proving that you can classify up to Z stability. And let me outline that quickly. right? So let's say this is going to be step one. This is what we're hoping to do, right? What we're hoping to do is prove that, so again, now A, oh, sorry, we'll now also assume right, so I have standing assumptions on A, which are up there. Now I'm also going to restrict to problem one. So I'm going to assume that A is Z stable. And I should probably also remark, that Z tensor Z is isomorphic to Z. The point being that if you take any C star algebra and tensor it with Z, it becomes Z stable. That is, it satisfies this thing. Okay, because if you tensor once with Z and then tensor again, it absorbs and you just get back A tensor Z, okay? So this isomorphism is the same thing as classifying things up to Z stability, all right? Okay, so now these are our standing assumptions. Now what we're going to do, or try to do, step one, would be to prove that A is isomorphic to B if and only if you have an isomorphism of something completely different. Okay, so this is the so-called Kunth semigroup. And I will explain later on what it is, but at this point let me just say that the Kunth semigroup is an abelian. It's an abelian semigroup. You can associate to any C-star algebra. And so step one here says, let's try to prove that two C-star algebras are isomorphic if and only if their Kunth semigroups are isomorphic and their K1 groups are isomorphic. Right? At which point, it feels like I've done some sleight of hand here, doesn't it? Because the original classification is supposed to be in terms of the Elliott invariant, in terms of K0 and traces. And K1, not in terms of this new thing, which, as I say, I will tell you later what it is. And that's a very legitimate complaint. I mean, if you were to say, wait a minute, we can't do that, it would be a very legitimate complaint because there's a sad fact. And the sad fact is that this Kunth semigroup It's a monstrous semigroup. It's huge. It's uncountable. It's not really computable in any concrete sort of sense, right? And so it would be a very natural and legitimate complaint, right, to say that this step is just silly. This step is silly because, look, if you have a classification theorem that uses an invariant, but that invariant is no more computable than the algebras themselves, you don't really have much of a theorem there, do you? Right? That would be a very legitimate complaint. And that would make this step seem silly. But there's a happy fact. And the happy fact, so this is joint work with Francesc Pereira and Andrew Toms, the happy fact is that if the Elliott invariants are isomorphic, then it turns out that these Kunth semigroups are also isomorphic. Okay? And therefore, step one is not a silly step. Step one is everything. Okay? Because, right, because what this happy fact says is that if you could handle step one, right, then actually you would have put these algebras in the classifiable class, classifiable via the Elliott invariant. It would say, if the Elliott invariants of A and B are isomorphic, then they're Kunth semigroups are also isomorphic, and therefore, if you could prove step one, you would have an honest classification theorem. And again, the point being that it's with respect to the right invariant, okay? With respect to the Elliott invariant, the thing that you actually can compute in many cases. So the real theorem here, so the real theorem behind this is the fact that this Kunth semigroup, it actually can be computed if you put, you know, compute in quotes. It can sort of be computed. You couldn't really do it in print, I mean, not realistically, at least not in most cases, but it can sort of be computed. It can be shown that this Kunth semigroup is the same thing as the Murray von Neumann semigroup of projections. Okay, the thing you build K0 out of, yes? It's the Murray von Neumann semigroup of projections, disjoint union with what I'll call SAF of TA. So this is soups of continuous affine functions on the tracial space. Okay, possibly.
I don't quite understand that, because in what sense would the V of A and the T of A be more computable than the W of A?
Well, So I mean this in a sort of concrete sense. So what I mean is, if you were to ask for the irrational rotation algebra, what is its K0 group? Then you can compute it, and you get Z2, right? Now, in this, actually, this is a bad example, isn't it? Because the irrational rotation algebra has a unique trace, in which case this is absolutely computable. So let me think if I can give you another example. I guess what I mean to say...
Surely arbitrary simplexes are arbitrary abelian, countable abelian groups are not very computable.
True. Yeah, I mean, it's a fair statement, isn't it? Maybe I'll retract that. How about that? Yeah, I mean, it's a valid point, isn't it? That this thing is really the part that causes most grief if you wanted to compute the Elliott invariant, I would say, for a general C-star algebra. In the case that this is a unique trace, like irrational rotations and so on, then it's not bad at all. But in that case, this isn't bad either, because this just becomes a half line. It just becomes a copy of R plus, right? So as usual, George, you have a very good point. As usual, you'd have another good point. They are all good invariants, aren't they?
Yes.
Pardon me?
For the CR1,
yes.
You have just counted.
Yes.
You need such stability.
I'm certainly using it, but there are other cases where you can prove this. So the other case where you can prove this isomorphism is when you have an AH algebra of slow dimension growth, which we don't know if they're Z-stable or not. But I'm certainly using Z-stability here. Right. So, well, okay, so anyway, if you'll believe this, then this happy fact becomes quite evident, doesn't it? Because what it says is that if you have isomorphism of Elliott invariants, then you also have isomorphism of Kunth semigroups. Why? Because if you have isomorphism of Elliott invariants, that means that K0 of A is the same as K0 of B, but K0 is just, you know, the group generated by VA. So that means this part is isomorphic to the corresponding part in B. Moreover, it means you have an affine homeomorphism of the tracial spaces of A and B. So if you have an affine homeomorphism of the tracial space of A and B, that induces an isomorphism of the SAF of the TA and the SAF of the TB. Okay? So that's the main result. And I also wanted to mention that this result is quite fun. You have to go back to some old work of Catasin. The proof here really depends in an important way on Katteson function representation. So if you remember, when you have a C-star algebra, you can look at all the affine functions on the state space, not the tracial space, but the state space. Yes? And there's an isometric identification between the self-adjoint part of the algebra and the continuous affine functions on the state space. Okay? And to prove this result, we needed an analog of that for the tracial space. That is, we had to understand what sort of continuous affine, or rather, if you take a continuous affine function on the tracial space, can you associate to it a nice element in the algebra A in the same way that the Katteson function representation works? And, well, as I say, that was an ingredient in the proof. Okay. So, right, so what have I done so far? Really, all I've said so far is that step one is the real question, right? I haven't said anything about whether or not step one might be true. And we don't know. I mean, we don't know if step one is true or false, but there is some evidence. There is some evidence that it may be true, which I'd like to briefly talk about. Right, so here's a theorem. And now you've got me nervous. Did I spell that right?
No.
Pardon me?
Forever doesn't have a double R.
Are you serious? You got to be kidding me. Are you serious?
That's Ben. It does have one R.
One R? Oh, my Lord. I, Jesus. Three strikes, and I'm out. Yeah, okay, so, well, is there any chance you'll tell me how to spell this?
Well, I can even tell you what it means.
Why, you already you already told me what it means. But is there any chance you'll tell me how to spell it? It's totally... you just said it was wrong.
No, I was talking about...
Oh, okay, so I only have two strikes then. I'm not to three strikes yet. Okay. Well, let me misspell your name and then I'll have three strikes. Like that, yes? Right, so what did Cheperka and Elliott show? They've shown that this semigroup, this semigroup, classifies so-called AI algebras. So these are inductive limits of continuous functions from the unit interval into finite dimensional algebras, and we now know that the Kuntz-Semi group does classify those things. In other words, step one is shown for that particular class.
I'd just like to mention that this is based on a lot of work of Leonel Robert, where he doesn't use the W or he uses traces, but he looks at a special case. So it's very much parallel work.
Okay. The other result I want to mention. The other work I want to mention is a wonderful, wonderful reformulation or identification of the Kuntz-Semi group. So here, I'll say that what's really needed is stable rank 1. In other words, you don't have to have a Z-stable C-star algebra for this result to hold. But Z-stable algebras with traces do have stable rank 1. In any case, what we also know is that this Kuntz-Semi group is the same thing as you look at all Hilbert A modules and you mod out by isomorphism. Okay. In other words, the Kuntz-Semi group really is capturing, in a real sense, the sort of representation theory of A. It's identifying all of the, or it's isomorphic to rather, the set of all Hilbert modules over A, modulo isomorphism. Okay. So this shows amongst many other things, this shows that this is in fact a very natural object, right? I mean, what is K0 or what is VA, right? This is classifying finitely generated projective modules. Yes? Right? And if you have an algebra, it's a very natural thing to say, can I classify the modules over that algebra? And K0, that's what it, you know, it's supposed to be doing for the finitely generated projective ones. And so what these three fellows have shown is that this Kunth-Semi group is a perfectly natural analog of K0. It's not just a classification of the finitely generated projective ones, but rather it's capturing all the modules over A. All right? Okay. What else? Let me just state quickly. Oh, well, let me go here. Let me state quickly some corollaries, and then I want to talk about some recent work of Wilhelm Winter. Countably, I mean, just any countably generated Hilbert modules over A. Yep. So the corollaries are this. We can classify. We can classify Hilbert modules, and we can classify unitary orbits of self-adjoints. Let me say it like this: in terms of, it's not, you don't actually use the Elliott invariant, but the data that you use to classify these things is constructed from the Elliott invariant of A. So let me just, I'm not going to be very precise, but let me try to explain what I mean here in the case of Hilbert modules. Right? This result, where did it go? Up there. This result says that the Hilbert modules up to isomorphism are already classified by the Kunth-Semi group. Right? They're already classified by the Kunth-Semi group. So what I mean here is that actually you can classify them in terms of the old-fashioned Elliott invariant, because there's a way for every Hilbert module you can associate to a projection, and that projection, if you're careful, will define an affine function on the tracial space of A. All right, and the point is that by the happy fact here, by the main theorem, if you like, here, right, that projection will either define an element here or it will define an element here. So the classification of Hilbert modules can be done just in terms of traces and K0, okay? And then you build it up to get something in the Kunth-Semi group, and then you apply to the Coward-Elliott Ivanescu theorem. All right, and in my last 5 minutes, let me say something. About recent work of Winter, there's been some very, very exciting developments. This was just announced last month, or at least this is when I heard of it. So here's some things that Wilhelm Winter has announced. He has shown that if you have a pair of manifolds And if you have a pair of minimal diffeomorphisms, each of which is uniquely ergodic, so a unique invariant probability measure, then what he is, he's handled step one. Okay, he's shown that step one is true in this case. In other words, he can show that the continuous functions on the first manifold after tensoring with Z is isomorphic to the cross product of the second manifold after tensoring with Z, if and only if the Elliott invariants of the corresponding things are the same. So this is extremely strong evidence in favor of a positive answer to step one. And this depends, I have to mention, this depends very much on Lynn Phillips' decomposition, which is well known to the experts, but I'd rather not get into it. But this is a very, very deep fact, and it uses a lot of high-powered results. And not only has Wilhelm handled this case, but more importantly, the proof, very likely, this part we don't know yet, but the proof seems to extend. In other words, it's very likely, in fact, I'll make another conjecture. I conjecture that within a year or two, Wilhelm will get rid of this assumption. Okay? In other words, it's very, very likely that Wilhelm actually has solved step one for manifolds and diffeomorphisms. He's definitely done it in the uniquely ergodic case, and his proof seems like it's going to extend and handle the general case of manifolds with no restriction on how many invariant measures you have. So, then we just have to go beyond manifolds and diffeomorphisms, and hopefully the general approach that I've sketched over there, hopefully that will be of use for the more general problem, but that's yet to be determined. So, thank you very much. Yeah. So the cases that are known, the only cases that I know of, I mentioned the real rank zero case, and there also are some one-dimensional cases that Lin and Matsui have done, but I don't think for higher-dimensional spheres it's not known. But again, I want to emphasize that this work of Dadelot and Toms, where they have embedded pieces of the Jiangsu algebra into these cross products, and so that would hold for any manifold. For any manifold with a diffeomorphism, Dadelot-Toms have shown that chunks of the Jiangsu algebra will embed into the cross product, which is not a proof of the whole thing, but it's very, very encouraging, especially given the relative commutant characterization of Z-stability, the analog of the hyperfinite 2-1 thing. It's very encouraging. Well, right. So what we know is that you can't classify them as soon as David Kerr slightly improves his result, we will then know that you cannot classify them amongst all nuclear simple C-star algebras, because there will be one that has, there will be two examples, one of which is a cross product, one of which may or may not be. for which the Elliott invariants are the same and the algebras are not isomorphic. So that problem we know you cannot do, well, almost know. And we certainly know it for inductive limits as opposed to cross products. So really you should regard this as a classification amongst cross products. This is the better way to think of it.
But if you're introducing this W, it seems to me that this general approach seems to involve two things. First of all, introduce the algebra V, and then secondly to introduce this the Kunth semigroup. But it seems to me you could introduce the Kunth semigroup without introducing the algebra Z.
Yes, one could do that, but I have chosen not to. But you're right, of course.
But then maybe this would anyway. Maybe this is would help in the direction that Roberto is asking. I mean, if what you're saying is that David Kerr's example is not to be stable and is hard to compare with other non-Z-stable algebras. Well, maybe this is very it's the fact that it's not even computable in terms of these more naive invariants. Maybe that would be a point in its favor.
So you're let me see if I got that. I'm not sure. So are you saying that it's might be better to just focus on the Kunth semigroup and try to prove a classification group, try to prove a classification theorem using the Kunth semigroup without assuming any Z stability,
well,
and then reducing to the Elliott invariant in the cases where you can. Is that what you're?
Well, whatever you can do, but if you could take care of everything in the Z stable case, then you wouldn't have to say necessarily that things beyond that were just not classifiable. It's not over till it's over. I mean, why not start using this more complicated invariant than the more complicated piece?
No objections.
So, it is very possible. So this is about your second step. But it is very possible to tell whether the dance drop that right in the case of all infinity or not entirely, we have to be easy.
Yeah.
But in this case, you also have Magnus type.
Mm-hmm.
But can we really tell?
Well, at present, no. No, I'm not suggesting that we have proved that theorem, although we know it in some cases, but we know it because of the classification. In the real rank zero case, for example, we know it because of classification, not because you get an asymptotically central sequence. But what I'm trying to say is that, right, because of the Macduff type result, to prove Z stability, it suffices to put a copy of Z in the relative commutum. And what we do know is that Toms and Dotterlot can put pieces of the Jiangsu algebra into A itself. They don't know if you can do it yet into the relative commutant, but they can certainly do it into A itself for these examples, for these cross products. So it's evidence, it's not a proof, but it's evidence that you might be able to tell. In other words, you might be able to prove that these cross products do have that Macduff property because you can already put chunks of Z into the algebra itself. Does that answer your question or no?
No.